Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
This is a Metaphysical Musings replay. Well, welcome. I'm Solazar and this is my Metaphysical Musings. Now, before we get into the show, let me tell you a little bit about me. I'm a speaker, a performer, a reader, a healer, a radio host, and an author. Now, I've been a part of the metaphysical community all my life, and along the way, I've even completed a series of formal studies. This show shares a variety of metaphysical topics, as well as a variety of guests or people who have information to share that can help us all on our journey of spirituality. I want to thank Angel Thacker and the New Age Guild for letting me be a part of the Spirit Talk lineup. Now, for those who listen to me here or on my Good Vibrations radio show, you know I like to start each show with a reading from Day by Day with James Allen. Now, in 1903, James Allen published his essay, As a Man Thinketh. And he chose the title from chapter 23, verse 7 of Proverbs, which says, As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. It was described by Allen as a book that will help you help yourself. He wanted us to know that in your own thought world, you hold the key to every condition, good or bad, that enters your life. Your present reality is a direct outcome of your past thoughts, intentions, beliefs, and actions, but your future is not predestined by your past. By working patiently and intelligently on your thoughts, your intentions, your beliefs, and actions, you can remake your life and transform your circumstances. In Day by Day with James Allen, his essay has been broken into a separate section for each day of the month. For the third day of the month, James Allen shares, Read the Right Books. People are anxious to improve their circumstances, but are unwilling to improve themselves, and therefore, they remain bound. The late speaker, Charles Tremendous Jones, told all of his audiences, You are today the same you'll be 5 years from now, except for two things. The people you meet and the books you read. The people you meet can't always be with you, but what you read in books remains with you for a lifetime. Are you engaged in a personal improvement program? Do you read books to learn as well as entertain? Do you attend seminars, webinars, or workshops to learn and enhance your skills? Do you engage your mind through new ideas and concepts? If you spend 15 minutes each day to read, you'll have read the equivalent of 12 books by the end of the year, and at the end of your 5 years, you will have read 60 books. The English writer Aldous Huxley, who's author of A Brave New World, wrote that every person who knows how to read has it in his power to make his life full, significant, and interesting. So as we begin the closing calendar month of 2017, ask yourself, what are you doing with your life? What can you do differently? And how can you expand your vision and your world? In addition to the words of James Allen, there are a series of things I do every day. I do a morning and evening series of forgiveness prayers. I do gratitude affirmations. I do Ho'oponopono. I do unconditional love affirmations, and I collect a positive thought from the Daily Word produced by the Unity School of Christianity. And the Daily Word for Sunday, December 3rd is, spiritual understanding is always available through your Christ self. Each of us is born divine into this physical world. Your divinity is your inner light. It's the essence of who you express into the world. Spiritual understanding is always available through your Christ self. How are you choosing to be? How are you choosing to express in the world? Bringing out your light and expressing your divinity is your purpose. It doesn't matter if you are a school crossing guard or the CEO of a technology company. Your divine light is your expression to the world. Now is a good time to choose how you want to shine in the world and who you want to be 5 years from now. This leads us into our guest for today. This past week on Good Vibrations Radio, I spoke with Dr. Lorraine Van Tool, founder of the Sacred Healing Well and author of Amazon Wisdom Keeper, a psychologist's memoir of spiritual awakening. Let's listen to that discussion. Lorraine Van Tool is a holistic clinical psychologist, a shamanic healer, a depth hypnosis practitioner, and she's worked with healers and psychotherapists and change makers at the UC Berkeley Counseling Center, the Native American Health Center, and she has her own holistic practice, which you can find at thesacredhealingwell.com. She's here today to talk to us about her book, Amazon Wisdom Keeper, a psychologist's memoir of spiritual awakening. Lorraine, I want to welcome you to Good Vibrations Radio.
Hello, Solasar. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed your reading. I felt hypnotized by those soothing words and beautiful message. It's lovely to be here with you.
It's a treat to have you. I want to let folks know that you've had a very unusual journey and beginning, and I'm going to ask you to give us details of that. But part of what frames you, I believe, is your multiracial heritage, where you have Chinese and Jewish, Portuguese and Dutch and Creole all combined into this one powerful entity called Lorraine Van Tool. And could you let us know about your growing up in Suriname, or is it pronounced Suriname? What's the anglicized version of it that we should say?
It's Suriname, which is English. In Suriname itself, we call it Suriname. And it's actually a Dutch Guiana. It's one of the Guianas, which are right above Brazil. Most people might be familiar with British Guiana, where that Jim Jones atrocity mm-hmm. happened.
Or even French Guiana, where Papillon
right. had
the prison. Yeah.
Yes, I went to that prison. So I didn't stay there. I mean, I went to visit.
So you didn't need Dustin Hoffman to help you escape.
No. I didn't. Who knows? Maybe in a past life, it was a very past life. So it's the Dutch Guiana, and Suriname is actually an indigenous name, and it was changed. I'm not sure what century. It may have been the beginning 20th century. That it was changed to Suriname. So it's right above Brazil. What is special about it, I think, is that it's, according to the World Bank, the most tree-covered nation in the whole world. So it's actually, there's a lot of Amazon rainforest that covers it like a big, thick blanket. And many maroon tribes who are descendants of runaway slaves have established villages in the jungle, and have done a very good job of hiding the past two centuries in the rainforest alongside with the indigenous tribes. And so that was very fascinating to me growing up, because we would always hear stories, and many of them in more recent decades started to move closer to the cities, but some of their architecture and huts and ways of living and being were still as preserved as ever. Some people even claim that their ancient traditions are more authentic or less contaminated, I guess, if you could call it that, than what their ancestors and the descendants of their ancestors are now practicing in Africa, just because they were hiding out so much and for so long. So we had all these low-tech documentaries and, you know, sometimes, shows and interviews and things on TV. We didn't have a lot of other TV. So that was really fascinating to me. I wrote about that in my book, also in the first chapter, an encounter with some of the Maroon people doing trance dances. So that was growing up in the city. There was a very mixed city, many different cultures, including more modern Dutch influences as well, speaking Dutch and speaking Creole and speaking many Asian languages. Our people were speaking them all around me.
And certainly that created a foundation for a lot of what happens afterwards. Can you also let the listeners know about how you left at the age of 10 and ended up in Miami, Florida?
Certainly. I really do believe that it had a lot to do with who I am today. And of course, there are unique individual aspects to that. Not all my friends, relatives, my cousins have the same story and same take on things as I do. But as I said, I think I was particularly intrigued by the rainforest, by the ancient technologies and philosophies, and then uniquely positioned against, in some ways, my mother, who is representative of Western education. She studied abroad for several years. She was a principal. And so there was a lot of tension between her worldviews and emphasis on materialism, education, trying to climb the ranks, so to speak, in those ways, and me being intuitive, sensitive, and very different. So there's tension there. And then on top of that, at 10, there was a revolution that broke out. Before that, it was quite a peaceful nation, but Suriname became independent in 1975. So I was about 5-6 then. So in the 5 years, there's a lot of scrambling for money and power, developmental aid, and that sort of thing. So that resulted in a revolution. And then in the next few years, it set in slowly that the threats and the chaos and violence by the dictators and the military people needed to be taken seriously, because people were kidnapped, there were accidental shootings, we had a curfew, controls were just getting more out of hand, a lot of strikes and bullets, stray bullets, you know, by my father's office. He was an architect in the city. And so my family left to Miami. My mother was sick and tired of living in a cold country. She lived in Holland for 8 years studying. And we were one of the few people in Miami, in Florida, from Suriname. And so it was a really hard adjustment, because my lifeline was the rainforest. We visited a little patch there every weekend, and the accumulation of all that, and then landing in this concrete jungle in Miami, really did it for me. It was at that point really lost.
And I would imagine, just as a guest, one of the things certainly I said is, I think you may disagree with this, by the way, don't take this, but I think you were brought in with so many gifts, and here's what I mean. I believe your multicultural background is a gift. It's a great gift, because it almost says you have multiple experiences presented to you. I think Suriname was a gift, and as you said, the rainforest itself, because it's as if the jungle can speak to you directly, even though culturally there are so many things that are speaking to you in that environment. And then when you come to Miami, you're suddenly in a place, like you called it, the concrete jungle, but it's a sterile environment. It may say it has its own culture, and it certainly does, but it's sterile in the sense of the depth of what you had as those gifts that you brought to it. So I suspect that time was a time of great uncertainty of who you are and where you fit into the world.
Yes, I would say you hit the nail on the head without giving much away. That was many of the things that you mentioned were the conclusions I drew at the end, of course, in the middle of it all. You're not fully aware of those gifts. But there was a part of me that knew I had come in with gifts, that also knew that I had come in with a mission. As I said, aside from nature spirits being my guides, I also had a connection with Anne Frank, Joan of Arc, and Helen Keller, which were a great trio to have as a little girl, as friends. And so they would, you know, they taught me a lot what about the world, but also what to expect, and also what my journey was going to be like in terms of, you know, writing a book and holding all this wisdom, being a leader, even when you're a young girl, the threats out there, being able to perceive things and see the beauty in things with your heart. I didn't have words for intuition and that sort of thing. But they kind of summed it up for me, what, you know, my strengths were and what to focus on. And so I also do believe it was a gift to experience all that, and part of the blueprint, so to speak, to end up in Miami and to be stripped of all that, so that I had to dig deeper and go back to the drawing board and experiment a little bit. It's almost like I imprinted on,
yes,
on those things that I was meant to do, but then it was taken away, and then I had to kind of feel my way through the dark and make lots of mistakes and, you know, try to be a popular, sexy girl, not, you know, knowing what to do with all this energy and sensuality that I lost, and then trying to be the student and scholar as my mother had told me to, you know, till I found my way back to psychology and healing. And then I thought I had landed where I needed to be, but much to my surprise, which is where initially I had thought the story of my book started, until my book coaches and editors say, no, you need to go back to the beginning. But I, in my mind, the story started then, when I was a graduate student and everything started to come back. All the drumming and all that energy and all the memories and my resistance to this explicit guidance to trust research studies and evidence-based studies and those kinds of interventions more than our personal experience and our intuition. And when it was laid out to me like that, that's when it was like this revolution inside of me, like, no, we're not doing that. But I also, when I considered, well, you could leave this field, there was another, you know, downloading of wisdom and insight. Like, no, you're meant to stay. You're to be a scribe. You're like a journalist on assignment, and start writing what you're experiencing as you stay. And so that's how a lot of the book was written and formed in the beginning, till before I even knew it was going to be a memoir. It was a lot of research and a lot of academic kind of style writing, and a lot of me just, like, you know, having these arguments with lots of backup. And then I changed it and wanted it to be more accessible to the layperson and turned it into a memoir, starting way in my childhood, which was a very good idea.
So let's for the listeners who haven't had an opportunity to see or read Amazon Wisdom Keeper, A Psychologist's Memoir of Spiritual Awakening, what was the epiphany moment in your graduate program for you when you said, okay, this really isn't what I was looking for, and I know that there's something deeper in me that I have to find and feed?
Mm-hmm. Well, it started in my ethics class with these readings, and Paul Meehl, if any of your listeners are psychologists or mental health practitioners, they might be familiar with him. He's a very well-known, respected psychologist who's no longer alive, but he was one of the youngest presidents of the American Psychological Association, so very respected. And he was saying all these things that I just could not agree with and accept, in terms of you know, that only a hard-nosed skeptic and a critical thinker could redeem our human disposition that's prone to self-serving bias and all kinds of things. Really, I felt that we're biased towards this rational mind of ourselves, which I saw, which I valued, but I saw it as a much smaller subset of our awareness and of this compass that had gotten me this far. And there was nobody who, in my program, which is very traditional, and this is 20 years ago, a lot has changed in that particular program, but there are still clinical psychology programs that operate this way, because I help and I work with students who go through them. But in any event, it was that kind of thinking. And I had been used to keeping things a secret because of censorship, threats of kidnapping and things like that in Suriname during the dictatorship. And then before then, even, I talk about the conflicts I had met with my mother and how feisty and extreme I already was and learned to keep my mouth shut. And then in Miami, there are a few years learning the language, learning English and being teased and going through so much, there was a good year of being selectively mute. And then speaking many different languages where you learn to just speak the language what everybody else is speaking. I gave an example, right? If nobody speaks Dutch, why speak Dutch? So I was here in this program. I could be a critical thinker. I have been a researcher. And so I wasn't speaking this intuitive language that nobody spoke, but also that people were explicitly diminishing, I felt, or devaluing. And so that's when it started, but it wasn't an immediately, okay, I'm going to say something, I'm going to speak my mind. It was very much an inner process, as my whole life had been, in terms of objecting to things. I would, you know, as a child, even walk in the rainforest, try to sort things out on my own, try to sort things out. So a lot of this sorting out now started to happen in my writing. And also I did a whole research study going back to Suriname, did a cross-national research to find out if I was really crazy or if other people thought like me. And that was very validating to discover many of the ways of thinking, connections with ancestors, this intuitive way of healing was very common in my native country and in other cultures. Mm-hmm. So that was validating, but it was still hard to bring that out because that was not the conventional way of doing therapy. So I almost had a double life. I kept that sort of secret and thought of it as indulgent and needed to be private and personal. and what I did and learned as a clinician needed to follow what I was, you know, my supervisors were teaching me. But of course, this caused lots of conflict, inner conflict and outer conflict, because it was going against my integrity. And so things were bleeding into each other. Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me, and I've seen something similar with other people with what I'm about to say, is that really your inner shaman was trying to make itself known to you and come out. And so this world of rational thinking was also declaring, you have to pay attention here. This is how you get your degree. But at the same time, your inner shaman was coming alive and saying there are greater ways and other ways of bringing your healing skills to the forefront. And isn't that really what your book is about? It's really about the journey of saying, I'm in this rational world and all you intellects are telling me, here's how I live it. But yet, inside me, inside this sacred woman, is my shaman coming out.
Correct. And the reason why I don't use those terms as explicitly is because I believe many of us are confused. We don't even realize what's happening. For me, it's not like I had ancestors in a lineage who were shamans. Mm-hmm. I was very intrigued by it. But I think many healers, modern day psychologists, even mental health professionals might have that similar calling, and they don't know what's happening. They think they're mentally ill, or they're going through this spiritual emergence that's an emergent, becomes an emergency and a crisis. And so that was very much the case for me. I didn't have the terminology, and I was a child, so even though I was very intrigued by shamans, I didn't even have the word that's a shaman, you know. Mm-hmm. I sort of followed what they're doing. So I'm trying to also find the universal common denominator between my story and everybody else who is waking up in this modern world, getting initiated by modern day institutions and challenges that are not aligned with spiritual order. I even call it, I say, our mental disorder is a sacred catalyst for greater spiritual order. It's not something to be concerned about. And so I knew that on one level, but then the other part of my mind was diagnosing myself and saying, you're grandiose, you're delusional, you're obsessive, you're this and that. So I was in this double bind constantly. I knew sort of how to overthrow it, and part of me is like, this is only skin deep, and this is an overlay of thought. But then when I touched into my power, it was like, well, I'm the only one who thinks that, and that just follows exactly this diagnosis, and I'm hearing things and convinced about things that nobody else is. So it was constantly going back and forth. But yes, eventually it became more and more clear as guides and indigenous teachers and readings started to cross my path at the perfect moments, and it became very clear that something was guiding me and something was also kind of chasing me in a good way, you know, not letting me get too comfortable and kept on having me step it up and find my path one step at a time.
Well, how important do you believe for the listeners, for everyone out there, how important do you believe their spiritual awakening is for them to find their, to be on the path of their life purpose, to be on the path of their life fulfillment?
Oh, extremely. I almost feel like it's an epidemic. I just saw this video by Malidoma Some. I'm familiar with this work, but this video on YouTube that's called The Pain of Being Called is just brilliant. I would really encourage everybody to watch this 30-minute clip. But he talks about it, you know, in terms of this great loss, not only of the individual but the community. He talks about his Dagara culture, and there's many elements. I have also West African ancestry in my maternal line. There's many things that he said that just completely clicked, and I'm working on my second book, and it's very much in line with what he talks about in terms of building the structure and set up for our bodies to have this other, the guidance from the this other world descend in us. But anyway, what he talks about is it's when he walks through a mental ward, I see so many of us struggling with mental illness and being called crazy. It's not only a huge loss for the individual and their potential, but it's a loss for the community, because their gifts and healing and medicine and guidance that is meant to come through for the community. And what I think happens in this society a lot, people are struggling, is not only that they don't recognize this themselves, but we live in a culture that is so plugged into other ways of power, the rational mind, intellectualism, all these other matrices that are not aligned with our spiritual power. So what we encounter, what we awaken, is not only our own mind sort of being blown to bits because mystery is descending and things don't make sense, but also this huge resistance. It's like a coming out process. And if you've come out in like places that are not welcoming, for example, of your sexuality, you don't have to experience it. You can feel that in the air, how thick that is, how dark that is, how afraid you are. So many people experience that in modern day society, but because they're born into that, they don't even recognize it anymore, and they blame themselves. I'm defective, I'm broken, I can't do this, I'm feeling, you know, depressed, I'm anxious, I'm afraid. All these feelings are in response to the dark resistance trying to oppress that person from fully emerging in their power, because if that person fully emerges, that person has a lot of medicine and healing for society, and that means society will have to change its ways. So in these cultures, it's still seen as a blessing, and people revere that and want that blessing, while here, it's completely the opposite in most spaces. So we really need to make an effort to find the safe spaces to emerge for us to be truly happy.
So is that, if I understood correctly, is one of the things you're saying is that because our society here in the United States has set up a certain set of norms that are expected from people, those that are expressing other than those norms are essentially ostracized, and that can lead to some things like depression or other feelings or increased feelings of a lack of self-worth, because I don't look like Ken, and I don't look like Barbie, and I don't look like these others, and I don't enjoy the social parties, so there must be something not right about me.
Yes, it's very, very layered. There's feelings, about the stories, about the feelings, about the stories. So you're in a story that is like several degrees out. But I think even on the most basic levels, in terms of this unruly energy, this wild energy trying, I call it, you know, our denatured self emerging and just doing its thing, its natural thing, its dynamic coolness thing, right? You'll have some reaction to being oppressed energetically in a space. Maybe it is a party where people are all about status and things like that, and you just like don't even feel like you can connect to yourself, connect to anybody. You'll feel agitated and angry and all that. So it will even be on that level where you don't recognize that you're responding to something in the environment, and you'll go and say, what's wrong with me? Why am I always so negative? Why do I don't feel good? Or your anger, your sadness about it might come out in some kind of fatigue or moodiness, physical condition. And it's all personalized. At that point, you're like, no, nobody's criticizing me. Nobody's saying anything negative. That's just me, right? And you just personalize it. And maybe that wounding becomes so big that now you're going to start to overcompensate. And one of the things you do is maybe make your appearance, focus on your appearance. So your self-worth now spins off, and it's all about your identity and how you look. And now it's a competition. You looking the most, you know, beautiful, like Barbie or whatever. And then that doesn't work out so well. So you become obsessive about the calories and the exercise and this. You see how far we spin off? It's just layers and layers. But the original wounding is that we are not celebrated or our wholeness. There's no space for it, and people don't recognize it when it emerges as, that's great. We do maybe on some levels when a baby cries. We might say, oh, how feisty this baby is, how great that this baby's calling out for her needs. But that's it. At two or three, you're like, you know, stop this tantruming. And it, right? And it starts to shift, and you become socialized and civilized, and you learn all the ways to be, like get put in a box, and it gets worse and worse.
So is that what you mean by the phrase that it takes only one black swan to prove that not all swans are white?
Well, actually, that phrase is often the phrase of using the swans is used a lot in classes, in research and statistic classes, when we're taught that that you can't really prove anything with a research study. You're only looking at chance. For example, you could go into many different settings and you'll find, you do your experiments, right, and you see what kind of swans are there, what's the color, and you keep on finding 100% like white swans. Because we now know they're black swans, they use that example to tell you, just because your research study keeps showing you that you have white swans every time you do this study, doesn't mean that they're all white. You might be missing that black swan that lives who knows where, that you don't know, you know, you're not paying attention to. And so even though psychologists and behavioral scientists have a huge big body of research and are very diligent and rigorous, making sure that you know, the studies are sterile and clean and well done, and you have this statistically significant result, that doesn't mean that the study is bias-free. Actually, this is a study that came out that shows that that many of the subjects or participants that are pooled or used in these studies make up only 12% of humanity. And they're often even outliers in many areas, many domains that are being studied. So my point was what I was trying to make. You know, you can have this huge body of research, but you forgot, you haven't looked at the black swan. And that's why you're so sure of what you're seeing. And so I feel like my book, by studying things very differently, looking at a whole different domain through a whole different lenses, and there's a lot of flaws also in terms of this, how the studies are designed. I don't want to get too technical and lose your listeners, but there's things that you can't measure. It's almost like the brush strokes are so wide and coarse. There's finer things to look at, and that can be repeatable, and that you can isolate some of these variables in the ways that researchers want to isolate them to say that their studies are sound. So my book is a different kind of research, qualitative, more phenomenological, more of a case study that back then, 20 years ago, wasn't considered as valid, as legitimate as the quantitative studies. That is all changing now. But back then, you know, I felt like this, my study is just as legitimate for those reasons, because I mixed it also with some quantitative research, and it it satisfied my standards. So that's what I mean with, I feel like my whole book is a black swan that can challenge even a huge big body of research that has a lot of white swans. So that's what it's referring to.
Well, a side point that I believe came out for me listening to your explanation reminds me of a card in the Osho Zen Tarot deck. And the card is called Comparison. And it shows a bamboo and next to the bamboo is an oak tree. And it reminds us that only human beings are the only ones in all of nature that choose to compare themselves to others that are like them. The oak doesn't look at the bamboo and say, why are you hollow? How can you be strong? And the bamboo doesn't look at the oak and say, why are you solid? How can you be flexible? And yet both have their place. And I felt, even with what you explained about the studies, it's also saying to all of us listening, is that we need to stop looking at the black swans as if we need to be one, if we're, or the white swans if we need to be one. If we're a black swan, or an orange swan, or a yellow swan, or anything other than that, we've all got to stop trying to be white swans. We have to be the swan that we are. So, And I know that wasn't what you were bringing out, but I really took that away also from what you were saying.
Yeah, no, it's great to, I like unpacking ideas. And I got even another thought as you were talking, which is sometimes there's not even much comparison made. It's kind of the idea of privilege. You know, now that we're talking about white and colors, it's just an overconfidence often, and a cockiness in the field. There's nothing wrong with being this white swan, and there's, like I said, much value in terms of what's being studied and brought forth. But there is a lack of awareness in terms of the position it takes, and then often a bit of an arrogance in the words and the phrasings, just like we, you know, this was the funniest thing when I moved to the United States, honestly. It was like, you know, you'd be the best in the world, whatever team, sports team, and I'm like, there's two teams that participated out of the, how can you be the best in the world? You know, we use this phrasing and this way of looking at things. It's the best in the world, is representative of humanity. And psychology, the Western psychology, and the studies that come out of our universities and are then spread out all over the world, we have no idea what impact it has, and the phasing and the just the air, kind of how it's held. It's not just, you know, the researcher's fault, of course, but it's this being aware of the position we play is, you know, imperialist and colonist and all that. So it has this tendency to overlay all other human experiences. This is it. This is what humanity is about. And if you're not like that, there's something wrong with you. And this is all unspoken. So it's not even sometimes a explicit even comparison. So this study, this weird study, looked at all these other cultures and just put things back in context. How much of all the I talk about, right, this proneness to self-serving bias, which in psychology research is just this accepted idea of, like, this is what all humans do, and therefore clinicians cannot trust themselves and their intuition because for sure they're going to be biased. Well, what they found is this is very much, much more prominent in Western culture and these particular subjects than in many other parts of the world. And interestingly, it is very dominant in these academic institutions. Mm. So talk about bias, you know, trying to circumvent the bias. It's like, it's just a very ironic situation right there, what came forth and what can happen and what can be in our blind spot when we're, you know, sort of looking to things in a certain way through a certain lens.
So you mentioned also that your book had made a shift. So perhaps you could tell us what your original intent was for your book and what the reader can expect today when they read it.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think the writing started even before I could write. As a child, I had fantasies of, I'm going to write a book and tell adults what really goes on in children's minds. But we didn't have journals, we didn't have notebooks that we can just scribble on and write on. So a lot I would just file away in my head. And when I went through that phase in adolescence where I didn't speak a lot, I did write to my friends and cousins back home, and that's where writing started. And I discovered that I was very good at letter writing. I was very good at saying what was on my mind and working that through the writing. And so when I became a student, college student, undergraduate student, I wrote for a student newsletter, but I also, in my papers, that was one of my strengths. I could relay my ideas very clearly, but in academia, you're not even allowed to use the pronoun I. So everything was really like analytical. It could be my ideas and how I was feeling, but I would factor, you're taught to factor that out. And so you would use, if it was a critique about the culture, you would have to look at somebody else who said something similar to you and then somehow weave that in, even though that might be your idea. So that's what most of that was. I was writing papers. I wrote about the multiracial experience. That was also my dissertation. You know, the psychological lynching of multiracial people in the U.S. was the title of my papers, but really where I was going with that was all the different fragmentations and the lack of a spiritual unity and all that. All these ideas were developing as I did many of my academic writings. And then when I started to veer off in a different direction and started to pursue that, working with indigenous healers, teachers, spiritual teachers, another voice emerged out of me, and it felt very much like a channeling voice. And that channeling voice had a very big picture overview of what was happening and my spiritual path and all that I needed to do, and was following that. And so I was very intrigued by that. I liked that much better than the cut and dry academic writing. But then in time, I wasn't sure how to integrate the two and what would make the most sense. So I was also guided to memoir writing, spiritual memoir writing, which in the end is what I learned as a craft. I saw that as the possibility of weaving all of my experiences in, telling my story and the power of my story, as well as, you know, the research, and but in a story form, and all the different things that influenced my journey. So that's what readers can expect. I'm very proud that some of my early readers call it a page-turner. I didn't think I would be writing a page-turner, but I like that it turned out that way. I like that I have gotten touching letters, even emails. You have people telling me that it transformed their life. It felt almost like they read a self-help book, which I wasn't, you know, intending to do. My second one is more so. But it was delightful to find out that people could really relate to their own spiritual awakenings, their own challenges, by reading my book, but because of my intention to have it also be metaphorical as well as a literal story.
Well, And I think that's the wonderful merger that you've expressed throughout the course of even this discussion that we've been having is again, with a lot of the what I'm going to call gifts, which at times may not have seemed like gifts, that you've had in life, you've been able to create a merger for the sake of sharing with others, and also a merger for the sake of using it for the healing of yourself and others. And I think that's a great gift right there for all of us. So if people go to your website, sacredhealingwell.com, what would you encourage them to explore, to seek, to find out more about?
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to piggyback on that comment. I really appreciate that. I often call myself a bridge, and I sometimes call myself a hybrid. And my most trusted guide, the first one who came through in the Swetch Lodge, is called Rainbow Crystal Woman. So it's very much this merging of different colors, different auras, different flavors into one, into the light, and dispersing it back out. So I really appreciate that. Now, on my website, The Sacred Healing Well, there's lots of information. There's a little bit about my background and my healing modality and my offerings. But my free offerings for anybody who's interested in going deeper, I have a blog that I've been writing for the past 3 years or so, and I have monthly contributions, articles and things like that that go quite deep. I also have a list, a newsletter list, where I offer a little bit more information. So if people are interested in signing up for my newsletter, they will get about a newsletter about once a month. I also have another website that's linked to it. It's one of my, I would say, paramount offerings, and it's called Retreats for Nature Wisdom Keepers, where I integrate many of the teachings and things, particularly to how to build a soul sanctuary to help awakening people connect to the sources of support from the seven sacred directions, so the above and below and the elements around. So there's more information on that website about that. So welcome to explore that. There's also, I also have a private Facebook group for women, and that one is called Awaken Your Amazon Wisdom Goddess. And in that group, I do little videos and meditations, and it's a little bit more private, secure, where people can try it all, you know, try these different meditations and maybe comment and say what they experienced. So that's available also.
And just as an observation, which I'll leave space for you to respond, when you talk about how you went through a period of not speaking, when you went through a period of keeping it all to yourself, I just want to share and thank you for the courage it really took to bring all this amalgamation of you out into the world, because you very easily could have stayed hidden, and you very easily could have chosen not to bring it out. And I congratulate you and thank you for your courage in doing that and letting us see the light that is you.
Oh, thank you so much. That's so kind of you to say. I don't know how easy it would have been. It felt like an inner tug of war, and it probably would have remained an inner tug of war. And I could have sedated and numbed it, but and that might have been easier. But yes, it continued to be a struggle both ways. But there's something about, you know, coming out, the courage, and to do that, as scary and hard as it is. The reward, the feeling of that release, the being seen and to be courageous, that makes it worth it. So I definitely encourage listeners or whoever who's struggling with that to continue plugging along and following their inner compass, following the beacons of light and strength and love. And not to give up hope.
Well, Lorraine, I want to thank you for spending your time with us today. And I appreciate what you're doing. We want to remind folks that Lorraine is the author of Amazon Wisdom Keeper, a psychologist's memoir of spiritual awakening. You can go to thesacredhealingwell.com to find out more about the book and other offerings, as well as to connect over to Lorraine's other site for the Nature Wisdom Keepers and the events going on there. Lorraine, do you have any event coming up that you would like the listeners to know about?
Yes, the next event will be a two-hour workshop. And if any of your listeners are in Seattle, it will be in Seattle at the East West Bookstore on December 7th at 7 p.m. It will be from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. There's a $30 fee, and I will be talking a bit. I'll do some readings from the book, but I will also do some of the meditations that I discussed, the Seven Sacred Directions meditation, using a tree guide and four elements.
Well, thank you once again for sharing all of that, and I thank Lorraine Von Tool for joining us to share her journey and her book, Amazon Wisdom Keeper, a psychologist's memoir of spiritual awakening. You can visit thesacredhealingwell.com to find out more or to order her book. Now, there are several highlights in the heavens that I wish I had more time to get to, but I don't. So remember, if you want to hear more detail about the astrology and vibrational energy for the week and month, visit goodvibrationsradio.com, listen to the Monday, December 4th show, or listen to the podcast later. We'll cover the astrology as well as the numerological events and vibrational energy for the month of December. So being forewarned, you can be forearmed. Just know that this is your time. This is a time of great healing for each of us, and healing is not circular. Healing is a spiral. It keeps coming back around, bringing up more elements for us to heal. As I close, I want to remind you once again about the anonymous poem from Empower Astrology. In the midst of hate, I found there was within me an invincible love. In the midst of tears, I found there was within me an invincible smile. In the midst of chaos, I found there was within me an invincible calm. I realized through it all that in the midst of winter, I found there was within me an invincible summer. No matter how hard the world pushes against you, within you, there's something stronger, something better, pushing right back. Whatever you give, do it from the heart. Thank you for listening to Metaphysical Musings on Spirit Talk. I'm your host, Solazar. If you have any questions or missed any elements, send me an email to solazar@gmail.com. Many blessings. We'll talk again next week.
There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free. If you truly wish to be,
I'll go it alone. That's how it must be. I can't be right for somebody else if I'm not right for me. I gotta be free. I've gotta be free. Daring to try to do it or die, I've gotta be me. I'll go it alone. That's how it must be. I can't be right for somebody else if I'm not right for me. Gotta be free. I've gotta be free. Daring to try to do it or die, I've gotta be me. I'll go it alone. That's how it must be. I can't be right for somebody else if I'm not right for me.